This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the U.S. narrative of Russia and Venezuela versus what's really going on.
Who's the aggressor in the Ukraine? Is it Russia or is it the United States and Europe? Who does the opposition in Venezuela represent? The people of Venezuela or other interests? The United States?
Over the last couple of years, students speaking out for justice in Palestine on college campuses are routinely being disciplined.
The good part is that opposition to Israeli practices and policies are on the rise. The bad part is the state and the Zionists are coming down with a sledgehammer against those who criticize Israel.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, every day we read something about the NSA in the news. What's the latest with Obama?
Well, there's two stories I want to talk about. The big one, of course, happened this week when we're recording, which Obama now is going to try and shift where our bulk phone records are kept. So that means all of the metadata that's picked up on all of us, billions of phone calls, which are now kept at the NSA, he is proposing they just be retained by the private telephone companies, quote, private telephone companies, for whatever length of time they normally keep them, which can actually be from 18 months to 10 years. So all of that metadata will be kept by the phone companies. And then when the security establishment wants them, the FBI, the NSA, whatever, they actually have to go to the Foreign Surveillance Court and ask for them on some vague standard which has not been articulated. Let me just say about this. This was what he had originally said he might propose in his speech months ago. It was complete BS then. It's complete BS today, and let's not be tricked. And I want to say why, because you don't have to believe me. Just read the New York Times editorial today. The New York Times, establishment, mainstream media, came out against what Obama said. And they said, what kind of BS is this? He says, I'm going to propose to Congress, they pass a law to make bulk collection kept by the phone companies and not by the NSA. And what they then say is he didn't need to do that. Tomorrow, today, he could have in that same speech says, as of now, I am stopping bulk collection.
Period.
Or I'm going to stop it at the NSA and let the phone companies do whatever they want. He didn't do that. Instead, he's going to extend the bulk collection law, allowing the NSA to keep doing it, and then throw into Congress the question of what to do. Well, as the Times says, forget it. Even assuming this was a good idea, which it's not to have anybody collect that bulk data for so long, but even assuming it's better for the phone companies than the NSA, which is questionable, but even assuming that's the case, it's never going to happen because you're going to throw it into a Congress that's going to finish it. And that's going to be years when we talk about this. So it's just a completely meaningless headline to make it look like Obama is doing something. So the Times goes after him for that, saying that he's extending the law at the same time he's throwing it into Congress. Secondly, he's setting up a standard so the NSA asks for the records. There's no particular standard they need to go through, and it's going to be in the secret court. So where are we? We're nowhere. Basically, what he ought to have done, he ought to, on his own, have simply banned the bulk collection of all our metadata and required them to have probable cause with a warrant to get a hold of that, the normal Fourth Amendment standard. It's an outrage.
Fourth Amendment was a good idea 200 years ago, and it's still a good idea. The FISA court is an
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court.
The judges on the FISA court are appointed by Chief Justice Roberts. They meet in a windowless room. The attorneys that appear in front of them are only the attorneys for the government. There's no opposition. And the track record of the, when last I read, 10,000 applications for warrants were requested of the FISA court, and they issued all but two. So this is what Obama wants to take us back to.
So this is a joke. So that's story one on the NSA. There's another one that I don't think people missed, but I first got notice from a friend who reads Der Spiegel, the German newspaper, as well as I think the other piece may have been in The Guardian. And it's about the U.S. spying on a company called, I think it's pronounced Huawei, H-U-W-E-I, which is the biggest maker of everything from cell phones to computer systems to software systems. It's the first or second biggest maker, along with Cisco, which is the U.S. company. So this article comes out in Der Spiegel, and someone sends me the translation, and it basically says, U.S. engaged in economic spying against Huawei, which is the biggest competitor to the U.S. company, Cisco. And they want to make sure that all the products that Huawei sells all over the world, this Chinese company, have back doors, and they know the products in the U.S. so that they can get into those products all over the world. So the story in Der Spiegel is quite decent or good, because it puts the emphasis where it is. The U.S. is doing this economic spying against the major competitor of Cisco, and it wants to just spy on everything in China. Okay, so that's the story. The Times then basically does the second story, the follow-up, because they must have either decided not to have done it originally, or they didn't have the document, which was the Snowden document, and they reported differently. They reported essentially saying, China is doing all this spying on the U.S., and therefore, to retaliate or get back, we have to spy to know what they're doing. And they quote at the end of the article a guy from some U.S. security institution saying, well, what we're doing to China pales in comparison to what China is doing to us. So the Times' spin on this story is ridiculous and outrageous, essentially justifying what the U.S. is doing to another major corporation in the world. This one happened to be in China. So in other words, as we've said on this program today, more or less, don't believe anything you read in the New York Times.
Michael, hard to believe it's that time again. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up.
Sixth annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 18th, 19th, and 20th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Old-time string bands, blues, jug bands, traditional Indonesian, Balkan music, New Orleans jazz, songwriters, and more. And a square dance, films, workshops,
but fun.
And the famous banjo toss. Ask me about the banjo toss.
What's the banjo toss?
They throw a banjo into the Gowanus Canal, which is a super fun sight.
Ruin that instrument.
It's a sacrificial banjo.
Okay.
But when they haul it in, they got to wear rubber gloves.
To protect themselves.
Last year, shot putter from Cincinnati won. And then you don't get the one you throw in the water. You get a new banjo for it.
So okay.
The Brooklyn Folk Festival, it's at brooklynfolkfest.com. It's presented by Down Home Radio and the Jalopy Theater. Down Home Radio is my son, Eli Smith, and they've got 30 bands. It's a terrific thing. Brooklyn is the center for the revival of folk music in America. So check it out, April 18th, 19th, and 20th, the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
It is an amazing event. I've gone every year and love it. And for you people listening who are over 65, which I know are some of our listeners, there's a smaller banjo they give you to throw. I almost won last year with the tiny banjo.
I don't get why the older people have a smaller banjo.
Because the bigger one is heavier. It's harder to throw.
The unfolding of the United States, European Union, Russian conflict over the Ukraine will have far-reaching consequences and will ultimately define the global configuration of power. While the Western power grab was largely ignored, the U.S.-EU propaganda machine kicked into gear, focusing on Russia's defensive action in the autonomous region of the Crimea. The citizens of the Crimea organized a self-defense militia and pressured the Putin administration to help protect them from armed incursions by the United States-backed coup regime in Kyiv. As this was going on, the United States has been active in the destabilization through armed terror of the Venezuelan democratically elected government. We're joined today by returning guest Professor James Petras, who has written several articles on the crisis in the Ukraine and Venezuela. He identifies it as the most recent cycle of the U.S. empire building in a three-phase system, including Eastern Europe, Latin America, Africa, and Asia. Professor James Petras, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
What are the stated goals with respect to the Ukraine that the American government is talking about, and what do you think is really going on?
Well, I think the instruments, the means, talk to the ends. The U.S., according to Nuland, subsecretary of Foreign Affairs, stated it very clearly. We've poured $5 billion into the Ukraine, building up organizations and politicians who are favorable to NATO and the European Union and hostile to Russia and eager to oust it from the bases in the Black Sea. I think it's a long-term project. It was engaging for a long time in building client organizations there. I think mainly in terms of electoral politics at the beginning, with mass political mobilizations as a complementary approach. So you have a target of a vassal state building and encircling Russia in line with what happened from the Baltics through Central Europe and under the soft underbelly of Russia. Now, at the same time as this is going on, the Russians are cooperating with the U.S. in many spheres, including the overflight caper in Libya, which ended in destroying the state, supporting the U.S. sanctions in Iran, allowing the U.S. to transport arms and personnel on their way to Afghanistan. So you have, on one hand, Washington aggressively encircling Russia, Russia essentially cooperating with the U.S. to gain good merit points, hopefully being accepted as a partner in the G8. And finally, you have this latest outcome in the Ukraine, where the U.S. sits down with Russia, Russia in good faith, says, look, it's an unstable situation. Why don't we stabilize it, sign the power-sharing agreement with the incumbent elected president, and your folks, your clients, get to be prime minister and influential in the Congress. Within weeks or less than weeks, Washington breaks the agreement. Their clients overthrow the government, engaging in all sorts of provocations, snipers, armed assaults, etc., seize power in a classical military-civilian coup, impose a junta, and a junta which contains neo-fascists, neo-Nazis, and neoliberals, a coalition of the extreme terrorist right and the neoliberal economic and foreign policy clients of Washington. This is totally unacceptable to Russia. First, the breaking of an agreement. Secondly, imposing a government which is totally incompatible with the Russian-speaking minorities in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. And this leads the Crimeans into major protests and eventually going for the referendum and decision to incorporate in Russia, both in terms of cultural and political defensive measures, but also as a way of securing a higher living standards. Now, the curious and most striking factor of this is that two-thirds of the so-called Ukraine army decide to stay in Crimea as a annexed state of Russia, two-thirds. This is a fact that tells you something about the hostility they feel to the people that grabbed power in Kiev. Now, the Russian threat that's been manufactured has to do with the fact that in eastern and southern Ukraine, there have been massive demonstrations against the junta, against the coup makers. They feel that these people are going to oppress them, repress them, and impose an austerity programs which will turn Ukraine into a basket case. So the Kiev government underlines that by appointing governors who are not elected, who are billionaire oligarchs, to impose order. And this exacerbates the feelings of hostility in the rest of the Ukraine. Now, in order to justify the repression in eastern Ukraine, they say the Russians are on the border, the Russians are going to invade eastern Ukraine, the Russians are this and that and the other thing. That's total hoax. What they're doing is reinforcing repressive authority against the internal opposition which is hostile to the coup. The internal opposition now doesn't want to join Crimea, but they do want a federal structure in which they elect their own governors and legislatures and not be forced to accept oligarchs in line with the EU policies. And I think this circumstance has been totally distorted in the media. The idea of a Russian threat is a concoction to justify an unstable, incompetent, and submissive ruling junta in Kiev.
Jim, what do you think the overall strategy of the United States is with respect to
I think
Russia?
It's very clear. It's to encircle Russia and return Russia to the status of the 1990s when they had Yeltsin in power and they pillaged hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars of wealth, which was laundered in New York City banks and other places, and which led to oligarchs seizing the wealth of the Russian people, and you had Russia as a no factor in international politics. Russia was weak, it was a vassal state, it was a country with no future, and I think that's what Washington wants. With the rise of Putin, you have the semblance of a state once more. You have a political economic order which is functioning, which has raised living standards, and which allows Russia to play a modicum of political role in world politics, in particular in the border areas. And Washington wants their image of Russia is the 1990s, and in order to secure that, they are pursuing a policy of putting guns right up to the frontier of Russia. In Central European states, they recruited these regimes, these vassal regimes, as partners in NATO. They recruited from them to engage in proxy wars in Iraq, Libya, other places. They have incorporated them into the European Union as providing cheap labor in the manufacturing sector and have taken over the major resources as well as the banking and media sections. That's the image they have of what they want to do with Russia, and it's similar to what they have an image for Latin America. They want to go back to the 90s.
Jim Petras, let me continue with on that line of thought, because the situation in Venezuela, if we can jump across the hemisphere, the situation in Venezuela is quite alarming. You've written, the overwhelming evidence shows that the Venezuelan opposition has engaged in prolonged and extensive violence, including terrorist acts, assassinations, arson, and destruction of public property. And this is something that you've written is being backed by the United States, and there's a parallel between what was accomplished in the Ukraine and what is sought to be accomplished in Venezuela. And we wanted to ask you about that as well. Can you give us your take on what the United States is saying about Venezuela and about what the real situation is?
Well, you have this farce, this clown, the Secretary of State, Kerry, saying we're backing democratic protesters, the government's authoritarian, it's repressing democratic protesters. Democratic protesters don't burn down 500 public businesses and installations administering social welfare program. Democratic protesters don't assassinate seven National Guard and policemen trying to maintain order. Democratic protesters don't blow up electrical grids and light up the national forest in a 360-degree circumference. So Kerry is just plain out lying. The U.S. is supporting violent terrorists. Those people that are engaged in this activity are engaged in trying to overthrow the government by force and violence. They've resorted to this because they've lost the last 10 elections in Venezuela, including a resounding defeat just recently in December, where they lost by 10 points, 55 to 45, in municipal and state elections, where the government controls 20 to the 23 governors. Washington has given up on the electoral road, and they're going for a civilian-based terrorist operation, which they hope will precipitate a military coup. And the government, far from being authoritarian, has not used the full powers. Can you imagine in the United States, if you compare it to one bomb at the Boston Marathon that kills three people, and martial law is declared in the city of Boston and adjoining suburbs, the whole city is taken over by the military. They go house to house, block by block, looking for two terrorists. What about the hundreds, if not thousands, of terrorists that have been blowing up buildings for 2 months? I think the government would be warranted to declare martial law and to use the full powers of the Constitution to eliminate this fascist threat and their political and intellectual authors and the economic power groups that are sustaining them. I think it's getting late in Venezuela. The right wing was able to penetrate the three Air Force generals who were engaged in planning an uprising this coming week. I think the experience I've had in Latin America, particularly in Chile, is when you don't apply the full powers of the presidency, when you don't mobilize and arm the masses, you're going to suffer enormous consequences because those military officials who are wavering and not sure what side the power is on are liable to side with the upcoming power, which is the right-wing, what I call fascist groups, which are profoundly anti-working class.
Jim Prentice, it's Michael Ratner. I have one question for you.
Yes, Michael.
I'm looking at the Times today, and you've already given it in a way, but your reaction to a number of headlines in the Times. There's two on Venezuela. One is called, there's two on Russia. One is called Quiet Admission. U.S. challenge now is to stop further Putin moves. That's a great one. And the other one is Obama answers critics, dismissing Russia as a regional power. So you have two headlines that seem to be the narrative that you're talking about of who's the bad one here. And then you have one on Venezuela that also is a huge picture of protests, protesting in streets of Venezuela with an eye on Cuba's government. So what do you think of those three headlines?
Well, I think it's part of the propaganda effort. I remember the same pictures in the Times about the women beating the pots and setting the stage for Pinochet's coup. I remember the same kind of headlines that were put forth just before the coup in Bolivia in 1970. The Times is a propaganda organ for the U.S. government whenever there is a serious conflict, particularly from a left-wing or progressive government. So I'm not surprised. The New York Times has not shown any of the charred buildings that the so-called Democratic protesters have burned down. They haven't shown the supermarkets, delivery trucks bringing food, the medical clinics that have been blown up. They haven't shown the experimental school that was blown up in Táchira. They haven't shown the cortege of the military National Guard people that have been assassinated trying to take down barricades that are blocking communication. Let's be clear about one thing, Michael. The targets of the terrorists, not a single U.S. business has been affected. Not a single major bank has been affected. Not a single landlord has had his property affected. All of the targets of these terrorists are targets against people and institutions and neighborhoods who are opposed to U.S. power grab. And I enumerated some of them: schools, clinics, supermarkets, preparatory banks that are microfinance institutions. In other words, this is a profoundly class war directed against anti-imperialist communities. Not a single pro-U.S. institution has been affected by the terrorists. That's absolutely clear.
Jim, let me step back. Now we've covered the United States' intentions with respect to the Ukraine and Russia, and we've talked about what they're trying to accomplish in Venezuela. But let's step back and take a more global picture. And let me ask you not just about Russia and Latin America, but about Asia as well. And what is the United States doing there, particularly with respect to China?
Well, the U.S. has a double role with China. One, they're highly dependent on Chinese economic activity. The Chinese hold $3 trillion in U.S. T-notes. All the major 500 corporations in the U.S. are involved in China. And it's a very much linked to the production chain of goods that go from Asia to China to the U.S., Walmart, etc. So there are economic links. On the other hand, Washington is very concerned about not being able to compete with China in world markets. The Chinese have displaced the U.S. in Latin America. They've displaced the U.S. in the Asian field. So what has been the position? The Obama administration, more than any previous administration, has dealt with problems of economic competition and decline through compensating military mechanisms. And Washington's deeply involved in two tactics. One, to build bases and encircle China militarily, especially at choke points in its economy. It's incited countries to make claims on Chinese territorial waters or contested areas, particularly Japan. It's built up a circle of bases, Philippines, Australia, Japan, and elsewhere, directly threatening China. And it's trying to create economic agreements, free trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific and others, which will exclude China. That's the strategy. It's an aggressive strategy trying to limit the capacity of China to compete in the world market. It's a way of maintaining China in the docile position it was in the 80s. And I want to underline one thing, Michael. Washington operates with images of times lost. They operate in Latin America as if they can turn the clock back to the 90s where they had neoliberal regimes handing over the national patrimony to U.S. Companies and eternally indebted with vassal regimes. Menem, Cardoso, Sanchez de Losa, all these rulers who thought first in terms of what are the U.S. interests and secondarily what are the interests of their country. The same thing with Russia. They operate with the image of the 90s, the golden era of pillage. They operate with the image of China in the 80s, which was a docile, emerging economy and was willing to put up with Washington on its doorstep. Those times have passed, and Washington doesn't want to recognize the fact that Putin has rebuilt Russia, Latin America has center-left governments, China is now the second biggest world power. So they keep trying to turn back the clock, and the only mechanism that they have is the military mechanism. They're not in a position to rebuild the U.S., in a position to compete economically. The press, the liberal press, the financial press, which you would think would push an economic agenda of market expansion, has fallen into line. The Financial Times should read the Military Times. I mean, they've taken positions that prejudice economic activities in Libya, in Syria, Iran, etc. I read the Financial Times every day, and I'm appalled about the stance they've taken, prejudicing investments, confronting Russia in the Ukraine, overlooking the coup, overlooking the junta, overlooking the threats that these pose to the Ukrainian Democrats in eastern and southern Ukraine. Military Times, not the Financial Times.
Yeah, perfect. Professor James Petras, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. If our listeners want to read your writings, do you have a website or a place where we can direct people to go?
Yes, just look up James Petras website on Google. James Petras website.
We'll do it. we'll connect lawanddisorder.org, our website, to that as well. So let me, on behalf of Michael and Heidi, thank you very much for your time.
Great analysis, Jim. Really great. It's
thank
really
you.
Needed.
Thank
Appreciate
you
it so
very
much.
Much. Let's keep in touch.
Thanks, Jim. You take
okay.
it easy.
Un abrazo, as we say in Spanish.
Absolutely.
Un abrazo.
Ciao.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice.
Campus and other protests about Israel. Israel is an apartheid state, and in favor of BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, are on the ascendancy all over the United States and all over the world. But of course, there's a reaction. The reaction of Zionist organizations, administrations, and others is to try and repress that activism. Today, we're going to talk about what's going on college campuses. Recently, for example, Northeastern had its Students for Justice in Palestine disciplined, and they're suspending the organization at Northeastern. Columbia forced students to take down a protest banner against Israel. The American Studies Association passed a resolution supporting boycott, divestment, sanction, and administrations and legislators are going after it all over the country. To talk more about campus activism, the repression, and the fight to make BDS a key issue in the United States, we're joined by Dima Khalidi, National Lawyers Guild attorney and an attorney with the Palestinian Solidarity Legal Support Group.
Dima, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've seen what seems to be an increase in student activism related to Palestine on college campuses in the last year especially, and really a crackdown by administrators. What have you been seeing, and how have you been involved?
Well, we started Palestine Solidarity and Legal Support a little over a year ago, and part of what we do is track this kind of backlash on student activists, especially. We work with all kinds of Palestine Solidarity activists, but the major backlash has been on campuses, because that's where the activism is most vigorous and spirited, so to speak. So what we're seeing are a lot of efforts by students, even academics, to raise awareness about the Israel-Palestine issue. And, you know, there's also a lot of movement around boycott, divestment, and sanctions. The movement for boycott, divestment, BDS, is really growing, and I think it's been the case, especially since 2008-2009 with Operation Cast Lead and the atrocities that happened with the attack on Gaza. It really galvanized a lot of this activism and the BDS movement as well. So we're seeing on campuses students doing a lot of awareness raising. They're doing unique and creative things to bring awareness to this issue. So we're seeing things like mock walls to illustrate what the apartheid wall is doing in occupied Palestine. We're seeing things like mock eviction notices being distributed in dorms to illustrate the way that Israel demolishes Palestinian civilian homes in order to annex land and build settlements.
At Northeastern University, students of For Justice in Palestine posted or slipped mock eviction notices that were clearly marked as not real notices under students' doors. And they were suspended, even though at Harvard University, for example, students engaged in the same kind of creative action and weren't punished as harshly. Why was that harsh punishment meted out?
Well, Northeastern's story is a long one. We've been working with Northeastern students since last year. When the university put their group on probation, the Students for Justice in Palestine group, SJP, on probation after they did a demonstration of an Israeli soldier's speaking event. And in that case, they did a walkout at the beginning of the event, and the event went on. But the administration said that they didn't get permission 7 days in advance to do that, and they were put on probation because of that. So this year, when they when some Northeastern students, some affiliated with SJP, distributed mock eviction notices under dorm room doors, the university right away suspended the entire group. This reaction is really problematic in many ways. The Northeastern situation, I think, it's kind of typical in a lot of ways, but it's unique because of the amount of pressure that's been put on this university in particular by pro-Israel groups and by especially a big funder of the university that's connected with the Zionist Organization of America. And, you know, I mean, this guy has a statue on campus. And so it's clear that there's a huge amount of pressure on the university to stamp out this activism by the SJP group. They're a very organized group of students who believe strongly in this issue. And so, you know, the reaction was really disproportionate and inappropriate. They sent the university police to students' homes, and they interrogated a couple of students. They filed disciplinary charges against two students for allegedly allowing students to enter the dorms in violation of university policies. While university policies do say you're not supposed to flyer, the issue with the way that Northeastern is responding, and the way that most universities respond, actually, is that they're being treated differently. So other groups that flyer in dorms don't get punished, and that's what we're seeing everywhere.
We're seeing this called anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that helps frame this a bit differently and give the university more ammunition?
Yes, in fact, I mean, that's really the underlying trend with all of this backlash against student activism and all Palestine activism. It's the attempt to label anything that is pro-Palestinian or that criticizes Israel as inherently anti-Semitic, as being motivated by anti-Semitism and the desire to destroy the state of Israel. So that really does underlie all accusations against these student groups. We saw that in the case of a number of Title VI complaints against universities in the last several years.
Explain what Title VI complaints are, Dima.
Yeah, sure. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, national origin, and color by universities, by educational institutions. And this has been used by pro-Israel groups to allege that universities are discriminating against Jewish students by tolerating a hostile anti-Semitic environment on campus.
They say that criticism of Israel, because Israel is a Jewish state, is ipso facto anti-Semitic.
That's right. And the examples that are in these complaints of an anti-Semitic environment include, you know, basic speech activities. There are lectures and demonstrations and mock checkpoints being staged by SJP groups and whatnot. So these complaints say that all of these activities make Jewish students that basically support Israel, to be specific, feel uncomfortable on campus, feel threatened and intimidated on campus, and it's basically asking the university to stop these kinds of activities. So yes, these accusations of anti-Semitism underlie all of this backlash, and we've seen this with mock eviction notices in several places, and at Florida Atlantic University last year. The Anti-Defamation League accused the SJP of actually targeting Jewish students with these notices, saying they only gave them, they only put them under Jewish students' doors. And this was found in an investigation by the university to be completely baseless. And, you know, it's the same thing happened at Rutgers, the same accusation that Jewish students were targeted. And we're seeing that response in every case. We have Jewish students coming forward and saying, this makes me uncomfortable, this makes me intimidated.
Let me ask you, what's going to be the outcome at Northeastern? What's the challenge? How are you guys doing with it? I know I want you to also maybe mention one closer to home. There's a situation at Columbia with a banner that was put out. And then some of the positive parts, of course, of the BDS resolutions that are being passed. But first, let's talk about the Northeastern. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, you know, the students have mobilized, and the community around them has mobilized around this issue. And, unfortunately, they have appealed the suspension, but I think the university is pretty set in its ways at this point. And, you know, we're working with attorneys with the ACLU in Massachusetts, with the National Lawyers Guild attorneys there. And, you know, we're thinking about next steps, because if it is the case that the student group is suspended and if individual students are disciplined for engaging in this basic speech activity, it will be an important and really negative precedent to set. And I think, you know, we don't want to allow the university to be able to get away with this kind of disproportionate and inappropriate reaction to this activism. So I think there will be continued pressure on the university from local groups and activists who are really offended by this reaction, and you know, we're considering legal options as well.
What happened up at Columbia with the banner?
Yeah,
at Columbia University, in Barnard specifically, the Students for Justice in Palestine group got permission to get a banner hung in Barnard Hall, where the university has, you know, for years and years hung up student banners in a very prominent place advertising student activities. And immediately after their banner was hung, which said something like Stand for Justice, Stand for Palestine, and it had a map of historic Palestine on it, the morning after the banner was hung, and this is hung, you know, by the university, it's not the students putting it up, they got permission, etc. The morning after it was hung up, it was taken down after a number of complaints from Barnard students, from mostly Hillel students, saying that they were offended by it, that it made them uncomfortable. So, you know, the university responded right away to these complaints. They didn't tell the Barnard SJP group that they were taking down the banner, but they responded right away to the pro-Israel group on campus, saying that, you know, we took this down and we're going to reevaluate our banner policies. And their justification was that we don't want it to appear that the university is endorsing this banner because it's hanging next to a Barnard banner. And again, this has been happening for years at Barnard. There has never been a situation where a banner was taken down because it seemed like the university was endorsing it. So it's very clearly a response to this particular banner and the complaints that it provoked. So this is something very typical that we're seeing. The universities are responding to enormous pressure by those who support Israel, by outside groups, and the burden has fallen on those who are advocating for Palestinian rights. When the subject is Palestine, it seems to be much easier for the university to respond in this manner. And the Center for Constitutional Rights has been writing to Barnard President, protesting the removal of the banner and this rethinking of policies just when there is this particular banner.
Yeah, there seems to be increasing activism around BDS in particular at campuses, including resolutions, but there also seems to be a counterattack. Can you give us some overview of that situation?
Yeah, there are a number of student groups that are trying to pass divestment resolutions at their schools, and there's a sustained attack against those efforts. And, you know, we know that Netanyahu himself has said that this is a prime threat to the state of Israel and that they're going to be counteracting it. But the typical response to student divestment campaigns have been efforts to, again, tar them as anti-Semitic, divisive, and accuse students of fomenting anti-Semitism on campus. So these are hard-fought battles, but they are raising a huge amount of awareness on campuses about the issue. And, you know, they're sometimes years-long campaigns to bring the issue to the university and to say, you know, we don't want our university funds invested in companies that support or are complicit in the Israeli occupation and Israeli discriminatory policies. So the backlash, the other kind of big event that has happened recently is academic associations endorsing academic boycotts of Israeli institutions. And the American Studies Association boycott endorsement in particular has provoked a huge amount of backlash. They have been threatened with a lawsuit. Their tax-exempt status has been threatened. And most recently, in seven states altogether, and in Congress, there has been legislation proposed that would defund universities, that would take away state funding, or in the congressional bill's case, federal funding from universities for subsidizing professors' travel or membership in associations that endorse boycott of Israel. So we are working in New York, Illinois, Maryland, Florida. There's now a bill in Kansas. There are also resolutions that don't have this punitive measure, but that are merely condemnatory. So they condemn the boycott and encourage universities to do the same. So we're working to oppose all of this legislation, which is so clearly unconstitutional and has really garnered a huge amount of support from a number of different sources. So, you know, in New York, there was the teachers union that came out against it and the CUNY faculty union. And a number of ACLU chapters have also come out very strongly against these bills. So I think they are, in a way, doing a lot of good for the movement and for efforts to organize around this issue.
Let us know how you got involved in this work and what sustains you.
Well, it was a long process of thinking about what is most needed in this country in terms of supporting Palestinian rights. And with some other folks that we an initial grant, we started Palestine Solidarity Legal Support to respond to this huge need for help. And so, you know, we're doing a range of things. We have an intake system where we respond to all sorts of requests for advice, for representation, and we're working with other attorneys around the country to help give that support. And we're also providing resources to activists, Know Your Rights trainings, things like that. What sustains us is really the activists themselves, who are really inspirational in their dedication to this issue. But, you know, of course, this is something that I think will be needed for, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. And we have to continue to raise money to sustain this organization. So, you know, we need everybody's help in that respect.
How do people get a hold of the organization, Palestinian Solidarity Legal Support? If we want to learn more about it and your activities, how do we find that out?
Our website is PalestineLegalSupport.org, and you can reach us at info@PalestineLegalSupport.org.
Dima Khalidi, it's great to talk with you. Your organization, Palestine Solidarity Legal Support, is doing a terrific job, and we're glad to hear your report, which is largely favorable. I think things are actually going in our direction, and that's the way that explains the backlash there. So keep up the good work. Once more, tell people how we can get a hold of Palestine Solidarity Legal Support before we say goodbye.
We're at www.palestinelegalsupport.org.
Thank you again, Dima.
Thank you, Dima.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Dima.
Bye.
Just as we finish this interview with Dima Khalidi, I get a note that says, Rolling Stones to play in Israel. Their first concert ever will be on June 4th in Tel Aviv. And, of course, it breaks BDS, so we've instructed our producer to never play a Rolling Stones record on our show, and the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement has issued the following statement, quote, we appeal to your moral principles and your record of standing up for human rights and human dignity, an open statement from the Palestine Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Quote, we sincerely hope that you shall cancel this ill-conceived and particularly harmful concert in Israel, and so do we all.
It gives me no satisfaction.
Oh, that's good, Michael. I can't get satisfaction. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Uh-huh.